involved in a church plant, and after a while, we got some bodies, and we had a small group of guys that were ball players and wanted to get entered into a softball league. Now, we had just a handful of ball players, and then we had some warm bodies to fill the rest of the spots, and we usually got creamed when we would play. As the church grew, we got some more players. Finally, we reached a point where we had kind of reached a level of mediocrity, so we could at least all get going in the same direction at the same time. One particular year, we had a chance to make the playoffs. Got down to the last game of the season, and if we won, we were in. If we lost, it didn't look very promising. Our pitcher, to give you an idea of the makeup of our team, our pitcher was in his early 70s. Our infield averaged about 55 years of age. Well, we got to this last game. We were ahead by one run in the last inning with two outs. The batter took a big swing, and he hit the ball off the end of the bat, and it dribbled about 10 feet down the first base line, and he swung so hard he slipped and he fell. Well, our catcher got up, ran down the first base line, and grabbed the ball. So he's got the ball, there's first base, there's home plate, and there's the batter just getting up. All he had to do, he could stand there and wait for the runner to come and he could tag him. He could have gone and tagged him. He could have trotted to first base and stepped on first base. But oh no, he decides he's going to throw the ball to first base. I was the shortstop. As soon as he turned toward first base, I felt like an Old Testament prophet seeing the future before my very eyes. I can remember yelling, "No!" And sure enough, he threw the ball about 5 feet over the first baseman's head into right field. The runner scored, and we lost the game in extra innings. I went home, put all my softball stuff away for the year, got a call the next morning, and the coach said, "Hey, guess what happened? We're in the playoffs." There were a whole bunch of upsets, and even though we lost, we still made it into the playoffs. I said, "Oh, great." And then I remember, because we're the eighth seed, means we play the first place team. Who we had played the first game of the season? These guys came out with pinstripe uniforms. It said something like Joe's Furniture on the back, so we knew they were in a city league also. We found out later that a lot of the team played for George Fox on their baseball team. Well, they beat us that first game of the season 25-5, which might sound like we got creamed, but it wasn't a full game because there was a 10-run mercy rule after a certain number of innings, so it could have been a lot worse. So that's who we played in the playoffs in the first game. And guess what? We beat them 10-5. Then we won the next game. And then we got to the championship. In the last inning, we were losing, and we came from behind and won the game. Afterwards, we were saying, "Old guys rule." It was great. Now, the reason I told you that story was I didn't tell it in chronological order. I started with the last game, then I went to the first game, and then I went to the playoffs. And there was a reason for that. To get across the point of old guys rule, I felt like that would be the most effective way to do it. In Matthew chapter 8 and 9, I came up with 13 different incidences of stories of events from the life of Jesus, and they are not written in chronological order. But they're written in a certain way to get across a certain point. And that point is, first of all, why was Matthew written? Who was it written to? Jews. To the Jews. What was he trying to get across? Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the Christ. In Matthew chapter 1:1, it says, "The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Why start out that way? Because that was really important for the Jews, for their king. That was kind of a beginning point. And then he goes into his miraculous birth. And then he talks about the forerunner, John the Baptist. And then in 5, 6, and 7, he talks about the words of the Messiah. And when we get to 8 and 9, we see that now he's talking about the works of the Messiah. This is almost like a job reference. Here's what I have done. Although Jesus isn't doing the speaking here. Matthew is for him. But here's what he has done. And all of these things go to prove that he is the King. He is the Messiah. And as we go through these different events, we don't want to get too bogged down and miss the forest because we're so looking at the details of the tree. So keep in mind the purpose of all these things was to show that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So he's presenting himself to Israel as the promised Messiah, and he authenticates himself with miracles, signs, and wonders. He goes from city to city and synagogue to synagogue, offering the messianic kingdom to Israel. During this time, he begins to get opposition from the Pharisees. He, in these two chapters, we'll see he reaches out and ministers to a leper, to Gentiles, a woman, to sinners, and the demon-possessed. Now, just as a little bit of review of what the Israelites would be looking for as they think about their coming Messiah, let me read a few verses from Isaiah. Isaiah 29, 18 and 19 says, "And in that day shall the deaf hear the words of the book, and the eyes of the blind shall see out of obscurity and out of darkness. The meek also shall increase their joy in the Lord, and the poor among men shall rejoice in the Holy One of Israel." And then 35, verse 5 and 6 says, "Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing, for in the wilderness shall waters break out and streams in the desert." In 61, verse 1, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound." Now, I'm going to skip around a little bit here. I'd like to read a couple of verses from Luke chapter 7. John the Baptist is in prison during this time. "And when the men were come unto him, they said, John Baptist hath sent us unto thee, saying, Art thou he that should come, or look we for another?" So John the Baptist is in prison. Some of his disciples come to Jesus and say, "Are you," basically they're asking, "Are you the Messiah?" And verse 21 it says, "And in that same hour he cured many of their infirmities and plagues and of evil spirits, and unto many that were blind he gave sight. Then Jesus answering said unto them, Go your way and tell John what things ye have seen and heard, how that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised to the poor, the gospel is preached." In that very same hour, it's as if Jesus said, "You're wondering if I'm the Messiah? Watch this." And he does all these things, and then says, "Now go back and tell John the Baptist what you have seen." What a great proof of who he was. Now, in chapter 8, verse 1 through 4, would somebody read those verses for us? John 8, 1 to 4. Steve? Just want to see if you're listening. Matthew. Good job. Matthew. Matthew chapter 8, 1 through 4. Yes, would you, Steve? Thank you.
"When he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. And behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, "I will, be clean." And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest, and offer the gifts that Moses commanded for proof to them, for Abraham."
Good, thank you. Now, leprosy is talked about a great deal in Leviticus 13 and 14. If you think back to the Old Testament, Miriam, Gehazi, and Uzziah were all struck with leprosy. Now, these cases were like a divine judgment upon them. It came upon them suddenly. Miriam was healed quickly. The other two were not. Naaman, who was a Gentile, also had leprosy. He was healed. But other than that, there was none. And there were a lot of miracles that the prophets did, to even raising the dead, that authenticated their message. And that's why when Jesus was doing his miracles in a lot of places, it would say things like, they thought he was a prophet because of the things that he was doing. Remember, he asked the disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And so there was a lot of that going on. Now, this raising of leprosy, I think it's important to, in light of what Matthew is doing here in chapters 8 and 9, showing that Christ is the King, he's the Messiah. If you look at chapter 7, the last verse says, remember in 5, 6, and 7, he was talking about the things that Jesus was saying, the words that he spoke. "For he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes." And then he gets into chapter 8 and 9 talking about his, not his words now, but his works. And he's showing that he has authority over all these things. Leprosy, I got this from a book by Arnold Fruchtenbaum. Let me describe leprosy here. The leprosy in the Gospels would refer to Hansen's disease, which is caused by a bacterial infection. In the vast majority of cases, the initial symptom is numbness in the fingers and toes, and if left untreated, the disease slowly progresses to the next stages. Yellowish lesions develop deep in the skin on the private parts of face, forehead, and joints. The hair growing in the infected areas assumes the same color as the lesions, and as the disease progresses so slowly, it can take up to 10 years for the microorganisms to eventually penetrate through the cellular tissue and reach the muscles and bones. Hair begins to turn white, woolly, and eventually falls out. There is a gelatinous swelling that forms in the cellular tissue. As time progresses, the skin becomes hard, rough, and seamy. Large scabs form, which fall off from time to time, exposing running sores. The nails swell, curl up, and fall off. There is a loss of mucous membrane resulting in constantly bleeding gums. The nose is stuffed and there is a constant flow of saliva. Because the bacteria attacks the nerves, the senses become dull. In the last stages of leprosy, the victim experiences extreme weight loss and becomes very weak, suffering from chronic diarrhea, chronic thirst, and a burning fever. Finally, there is an attack on the internal and vital organs leading to death. Now, in Luke's account of this passage, remember Luke was a doctor, he says this man is full of leprosy. In other words, it had been a well-developed case, so he's in bad shape. There was talking about Hansen's disease, read that there was I think it was called a leprosarium, that was in the United States, started in late 1800s, and it didn't close until 1999. It was in Carville, Louisiana, where they would treat these folks with Hansen's disease. But anyway, if you look at Leviticus 13 and 14, they would have to go to the priest. The priest would declare them leprous. Then they would have to tear their garments and walk around in torn clothes, faces covered with nose down, ostracized from the Jewish community, live in places reserved for lepers. They were prohibited from entering the tabernacle or the temple compound. If touched, they became ceremonially unclean. When traveling, they had to say unclean and cover their mouth. Now, this leper came to Jesus humbly, and he believed. He had no doubt that he could cleanse him from his defilement, and he was immediately cleansed. The thing that stood out to me was, I was thinking about, I saw this little illustration one time, if you had a glass of muddy water and a glass of clean water, if you pour the clean water into the dirty water is still dirty. If you take the dirty water and pour it into the clean becomes dirty. It doesn't stay clean. But it struck me, the holiness of Jesus is so strong that just that touch was enough to cleanse him, and how the holiness of God is so great that he can cause someone to be cleansed like this. In Mark's version of this, it says that Jesus was moved with compassion. The big thing about this is, and I think this is one of the reasons that this is the first event that Matthew talks about as he begins this series of events to prove that Jesus is the Messiah, because this is a big deal that somebody is cleansed of leprosy. There's no other account of this happening other than the weird different examples that I gave. But this is something that the prophets didn't do, and it was a big deal. And notice what he says at the end. He tells him to go to the priest for a testimony unto them. Now, the priest would, I assume, know about this leper because they had to pronounce him a leper. And now he comes back, and as they check their health records, oh yeah, this guy had leprosy and now looks like he's clean. And they have to go through all the rigmarole that is talked about in Leviticus 13 and 14. But Jesus did that, says, sent him to them for a testimony unto them. In other words, go tell the priest what has taken place, because I want them to see this is almost like Jesus throwing down the gauntlet, so to speak, of who he is. This event, I don't know about you, but I know for me, I can read, oh yeah, he cleansed the leper and, you know, he healed everybody. But this event is a very unique, big deal. And he sent him back to the priest specifically to let him know, let the authorities know, something special is going on here. Now, so first of all, we see that there's authority over defilement. Now in the next passage, 5 through 13, let me read this quickly. And when Jesus was entered into Capernaum, there came unto him a centurion beseeching him and saying, Lord, my servant lieth at home sick of the palsy, grievously tormented. And Jesus saith unto him, I will come and heal him. The centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that thou shouldest come under my roof, but speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed. For I am a man under authority, having soldiers under me, and I say to this man, go, and he goeth, and to another, come, and he cometh, and to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to them that followed, verily I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And I say unto you that many shall come from the east and the west, and shall sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the children of the kingdom shall be cast out into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Jesus said unto the centurion, go thy way, and as thou hast believed, so be it done unto thee. And his servant was healed in the selfsame hour. Now the centurion was an officer in the Roman army, had authority over 100 men. He must have had a unique servant that was extremely valuable to him. Now, in the other accounts, it said that one said that he sent the elders of the Jews, another one he sent his servants. So, but in the Talmud, it said if a man's agent is sent, it's just like he was there. So the fact that there seems to be a discrepancy there isn't a big deal about who actually came. So apparently a servant was come on behalf of the centurion. But anyway, Jesus marveled at his faith. He said, I haven't seen this faith in Israel. And he spoke and healed this servant. And he wasn't even present. And I couldn't think of a better word for this, but it is put authority over distance. He spoke the word. When you think of he spoke and something came into being, what might come to mind? Creation. Again, we see this personal authority that Jesus had. And he wasn't doing it over, he didn't have to even be present with the individual, but he could speak and healing would take place. And then in verse 14, the next event, when Jesus was coming to Peter's house, he saw his wife's mother laid and sick of a fever, and he touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she arose and ministered unto them. When the even was come, they brought unto him many that were possessed with devils, and he cast out the spirits with his word and healed all that were sick, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, himself took our infirmities and bare our sicknesses. So there was a synagogue service. After the service, they went back to Peter's house for a potluck. And it says when even was come, so the Sabbath had to be over before they could, you know, come to see Jesus. And he healed and took care of everybody. He instantly healed Peter's mother-in-law. And again, from Luke's account, we see that this had been a long time illness that she had. And you would think she would be weak after that, but she instantly gets up and starts to serve. Total, complete healing. So here we see Jesus with his authority over disease. Now in verse 17, where it refers back to Isaiah 53, remember Isaiah 53 is talking about sin and forgiveness of sin. And Matthew is using that spiritual truth and applying it to a physical reality, and that's why this verse is used here. They weren't healed in this case by Jesus' death on the cross because Jesus hadn't even died on the cross yet. So that wouldn't make too much sense. So don't get messed up by that. But if you go to Isaiah 53, you'll see that it's talking about forgiveness of sins, where it uses that, where he took our infirmities and bare our sicknesses. Now in verse, so there's authority over disease. And then in 19 through 22, and a certain scribe came and said, Master, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest. And Jesus saith unto him, the foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. And another of his disciples said unto him, Lord, suffer me first to go and bury my father. But Jesus said unto him, follow me and let the dead bury the dead. Now here we see his authority over man. He's looking for a commitment. Count the cost if you're going to follow me as king. And to the other guy that wanted to bury his father first, now his father didn't just die and he's going to go to the funeral, and Jesus is not being compassionate here. This guy's father would still be alive. He's probably the firstborn son. It was the duty of the firstborn son to say a certain prayer called the Kaddish. I don't know what that involved, but at the funeral of the father. So this father could have been alive for another 5 or 10 years, and that's what he's talking about. And Jesus is saying, no, the time is now. If you're going to do it, come and follow me now. So it's authority over disease, authority over man. And then in verse 18, it says, now when Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave commandment to depart unto the other side. And then there's that short passage here with 19 to 22. And then if you skip down to verse 23, it kind of picks up the story there. And when he was entered into his ship, his disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great tempest in the sea, and so much that the ship was covered with waves. But he was asleep, and his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we perish. And he saith unto them, Why are ye fearful, O ye of little faith? And he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. But the men marveled, saying, What manner of man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him? And chronologically, this event followed a major rejection that had just happened by the religious leaders of Jesus. The disciples are probably kind of downcast over this whole thing, and now they're out on this boat. And I'm sure you know, storms come up on the Sea of Galilee a lot, and they come up quickly because of the surrounding terrain there. This was no ordinary storm. These are experienced fishermen, and they're afraid. This was a big storm. It made me think that, you know, Satan had some power with the weather when God allowed it. I wonder if this storm was actually something Satan brought up with the intent to kill the Messiah. But Jesus comes out and he says, Peace be still, and everything gets calm. When I was teaching fourth grade, we had one of those stretches in the wintertime where it's just rain for about 10 days straight, and we had indoor recess. If you've ever been a teacher and you've had indoor recess for a while, you know how that can be very painful. Finally, one day, after about 10 days of this, I looked out the window and I saw it wasn't raining. It was in the middle of math class. I said, guys, get your coats on. We're going outside for recess, early recess. Yay! Everybody gets their coats, and we go to the door, and I opened up the door, and it started to rain again. And I said, guys, watch this. And I stepped out. Peace, be still. And you know what happened? Nothing. But it gave me an opportunity to talk about this story a little bit and explain why I couldn't do what Jesus did. But anyway, these fishermen marveled. That tells me this is no ordinary storm. This was no ordinary end to a storm. And they looked at Jesus and said, Who is this? What authority does he have that he can control nature? And again, don't miss the forest for looking at the tree. Remember what Matthew is doing. He's giving all these events that are showing Jesus is the King. He is the Messiah. He's got authority over disease. He's got authority over defilement, authority over man. He's got authority over nature. And then we get to verse 28. And when he was come to the other side in the country of the Gergesenes, there met him two possessed with devils coming out of the tombs, exceeding fierce, so that no man might pass that way. And behold, they cried out, saying, What have we to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God? Art thou come hither to torment us before the time? And there was a good way off from them, a herd of many swine feeding. So the devils besought him, saying, If thou cast us out, suffer us not to go away into the herd of swine. And he said unto them, Go, and when they were come out, they went into the herd of swine. And behold, the whole herd of swine ran violently down a steep place into the sea and perished in the waters. And they that kept them fled and went their ways into the city and told everything and what was befallen to the possessed of the devils. And behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus. And when they saw him, they besought him that he would depart out of their coast. So this guy that's possessed with a demon, he's he dwelt in tombs, he showed superhuman strength, he wailed constantly, self-destructive, he was aggressive, he was naked, combining all the other accounts. But the demons recognized two things about Jesus. They acknowledged him as the Son of God, and they acknowledged their ultimate doom. And when he asked, "What is your name?" There were exorcisms that were done by others in this time period. And what they would do was they would ask what the usual method was, ask the demon what his name was, and he could find out his name, then he could cast him out by using his name. But if the guy was dumb, they weren't able to cast him out. Now, sometimes Jesus would ask the name, and he does in this case, finds out his name is Legion. And for some reason, don't know why, but he allows them to go into the swine. Remember, we're in Gentile territory here, so it's no big deal that these folks had swine. And they went in and destroyed themselves. And the people asked Jesus to leave. But what we learn from this passage is the authority that Jesus has over the demons. And then we get into chapter 9. This is a story, I don't think I'll take the time to read all this because of lack of time here, but this is a story where he's lowered down into this home, the man that was lame. Now, in Luke's version of this, it says in 5:17, "And it came to pass on a certain day as he was teaching that there were Pharisees and doctors of the law sitting by, which were come out of every town of Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem, and the power of the Lord was present to heal them." So now, in this story, in chapter 9, all of these doctors and different Pharisees were coming from these different towns. The reason was they had heard about the healings of Jesus, what he had done, particularly the healing of the leper. And what would happen is they would send out a delegation, first of all, to see what was going on. And they wouldn't ask questions or anything. They would just observe. Then they would go back to Jerusalem and report in to headquarters and say, "Hey, there's something going on here. We need to check this out." Then another delegation would be sent out, and then they would start asking questions. Now, in this particular passage, as Jesus, let me pick it up here with... Let me just read this. "And he entered into a ship and passed over and came into his own city. And behold, they brought to him a man sick of palsy, lying on a bed. Jesus, seeing their faith, said unto the sick of the palsy, 'Son, be of good cheer, thy sins be forgiven thee.'" Now, who can forgive sins? God. "And behold, certain of the scribes said within themselves, 'This man blasphemeth.' And Jesus, knowing their thoughts..." Now remember, they were sent out just to watch and observe. This wasn't time for asking questions and everything. "Wherefore think ye evil in your hearts? For whether is easier to say, 'Thy sins be forgiven thee,' or to say, 'Arise and walk'? But that ye may know that the Son of Man hath power on the earth to forgive sins," and saith he to the sick of the palsy, "Arise, take up thy bed, and go into thy house." And he arose and departed to his house. But when the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God, which had given such power unto men. Let's suppose I'm a newcomer to Hillcrest, and I come in here and I say, "I'm the best chess player in this church." Now, you all know that every game day, I'm making this up now, every game day there is a single elimination chess tournament. And for the last 10 years, the guy who has won every one is Steve Morris. Now, And this isn't a challenge, by the way, because I'm not a good chess player. I can come in here and say, I'm the best player in the church. That's easy to do. But what would be harder to do? To sit down and play him and beat him. That would be harder, wouldn't it? There was a saying in the Midwest. I don't think it's biblical, but it said, talk's cheap, it takes money to buy whiskey. But that applies here. And Jesus is saying, anybody can say your sins are forgiven, but to prove that that's true, I'm going to raise this guy up. Which is harder for me to do? To say something or to do something? The fact that I can do this is proof that what I said is true. And that's why everybody's, whoa. And again, remember what Matthew is trying to do. He's letting the people to whom he is writing know beyond any shadow of a doubt that Jesus is the Christ, he's the Messiah, he is the King. And here's proof. And here's another proof. He had authority over the forgiveness of sins. And then in 9 through 13, he says, and as Jesus passed forth from thence, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the receipt of the customs. And he saith unto him, follow me. And he arose and followed him. And it came to pass that Jesus sat at meat in the house. Behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto the disciples, why eateth your master with publicans and sinners? But when Jesus heard that, he said unto them, they that behold need not a physician, but they that are sick. By the way, I forgot to mention something back in chapter 8. Verse 11, where it talks about sitting down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, there's proof Jesus is talking about the resurrection. There's going to be a resurrection. And when he says the children of kingdom, but the children of the kingdom shall be cast out into outer darkness, the Pharisees proudly called themselves children of the kingdom. He's not talking about saved people, but that's what he was getting at in that passage. Anyway, back to this one with Matthew. This is the beginning of the second stage of the investigation, where the stage of interrogation, which would continue until the turning point in Matthew 12, tax collectors were hated. In the rabbinic writings, it said publicans were the exact opposite of a righteous man. He was a gross sinner. He was officially ostracized from the Jewish community. He was only allowed to associate with publicans and prostitutes. Pharisees declared that repentance was virtually impossible for a publican. He could not be a judge or even be a witness in a court of law. And there were two types. There was the income tax official and the custom official, which was the worst kind. And Matthew was a custom official. Now, Pharisees break their silence as he's eating with these bad people, and Jesus' response is, it is the sick that need a doctor. So there's lack of mercy due to the rules and regulations that they had. And it's not the righteous that need to be called to repentance, but the sinners. From this point on, they followed and raised objections to the things he said or did. Now, a couple things about the Pharisees. Following the completion of the Old Testament, there was a transition that occurred from biblical Judaism to the rabbinic schools, or Pharisaic Judaism. There was a certain school of rabbis called the Sopharim, and they came up around 450 BC to 30 AD. They said, and I think this is probably accurate, I've seen this number before, but they said in the law there are 613 commandments. Now remember, they had just come out of Babylonian captivity. They wanted to be extra sure that they did not go back into Babylonian captivity. So they thought, to make sure we don't break any of these rules, we need to kind of build a fence of more rules and regulations to keep us from doing this. There was one law that said not to see the kid in the milk of its mother, talking about a baby goat. And the thought is that the Babylonians would take a kid, baby goat, boil it in the milk of its mother, and then offer it as a sacrifice to Baal. Well, the Israelites weren't doing that, but they took that commandment and they said, you know, if you drink milk and eat meat at the same time, and that meat came from the goat that gave the milk, you're seething a kid in your stomach. We can't do that. That would be breaking the law. So to get around that, if you had milk, you couldn't eat meat for another 4 hours. That became a new rule. And then it got to the point where if you had, let's say, cheese on a plate for lunch, and you washed the plate, and then at dinner you had meat on that same plate, but there was a little speck of cheese that you missed, and you ate that, and it came from the same source, again you're doing that. So now you've got to have two sets of dishes, one for dairy and one for meat. And if you forget and use this plate for meat sometime, you've got to destroy that plate or give it to a Gentile. That's what was going on here. They said, they worked off a principle that said, you can argue with a sofer, but you can't argue with the law. Then around the time of Jesus, another school, Tanaim, came up around 30 AD. They said, you know, there's still too many loopholes in this. We've got to build another fence. So they added to these rules, made things even worse. And they said, you can argue with another tanim, but you can't argue with a sofer or the law. And at that point, they made this equal to this. That's the stuff that Jesus was dealing with. Then, around 220, they said that this was the oral law that was given to Moses, and it was passed on to Joshua and orally down the road. So it was equivalent to this. In 220, it was actually written down. And these guys said you can argue with a amora, but you can't argue with a tanim or a sofer. And now this whole mess becomes equivalent to the law. It would be like, using a modern day illustration, if the Old Testament had a verse that said, you can't watch sports on TV on Sunday. I know some of you ladies are, I think I read that. No, it's not in there, okay? This is just an illustration. But let's say that was in there. The next group comes along, the sofers, and they say, you can't watch any sports on TV. The next group comes along, and they say, you can't even own a TV. And the next group comes along and says, you can't even own an appliance. That's kind of how it progressed. And some of the stuff gets really weird. This and this became, let me make sure I spell this correctly, became the Mishnah. This was called the Gemara, And these two combined became the Talmud. Now, in verse 14, this was what Jesus was fighting. Because these Pharisees, the Messiah's got to be a Pharisee. So he's got to follow all these different rules that we have. In verse 14, it says, "Then came to him the disciples of John, saying, why do we and the Pharisees fast off, but thy disciples fast not? Jesus saith unto them, Can the children of the bridegroom mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken from them, and then shall they fast." And then he talks about putting a piece of new cloth on an old garment and putting new wine into old wineskins. This is talking about his authority over tradition and this stuff. Putting, patching up an old piece of clothing. The old piece of clothing is going to, will have shrunk, so it's at its permanent size. And if you put a new patch on that and sew it in there, when that shrinks, it's going to mess everything up and ruin the shape. So you don't want to do that. With the wineskin, an old wineskin is going to be stretched as far as it will go. But if you put new wine in there as it ferments and it expands, it's going to ruin that old wineskin. So Jesus is saying, I'm not coming to do that. This isn't a patch job. This is something totally new. We're getting away from this. We're saved by grace through faith. And Jesus is the King. He's the Messiah. He has authority over the tradition. Then in verses 18 through 26, here he talks about another, a daughter who is dead, and Jesus raises her from the dead. She obviously is dead. They have the mourners there. And this is as if we're in the middle of a funeral, so to speak. And he raises her from the dead. He says authority over disease and death. And then in 27 through 31, we see that he heals some blind, two blind men. And then in 32 through 34, cast out demon again. This one was unusual because this was a demon that had caused dumbness. So the man couldn't speak. So when they said, what is your name? Couldn't get that out. But Jesus cast it out. And it says in verse 33, and when the devil was cast out, the dumb spake and the multitudes marveled, saying, it was never so seen in Israel. Well, there had been demons cast out before, yeah, but not like this one. This one was different. And then in verse 35 through 38, I think this probably would be better served as an introduction to chapter 10, but nevertheless, it's where Jesus looks over the people. When he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. Then saith he unto the disciples, the harvest truly is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send forth laborers into his harvest. Here we see that he has authority over the harvest. If you think about a harvest, it takes planting. It takes good soil. It takes weed removal. It takes patience. Relies on the weather for good results. It takes laborers, but it has great rewards. remember what we have seen Matthew say here. Jesus has authority over defilement, over distance, over disease, over man, over nature, over demons, over tradition, over disease and death, over blindness, and over the harvest. Jesus is the King. Jesus is the Messiah. And that's the point he's trying to make out of these couple chapters here. Let's pray. Father, thank you for sending Jesus to die for us. We thank you for all the proofs we have that he is the promised one that was to come and be our Savior. Thank you that you love and care for us. Pray for the service ahead, that you would speak to hearts. In Jesus' name, amen.